Chapter 9. Formation of a general rate of profit, average rate of profit, and transformation of the values of commodities into prices of production. The organic composition of capital depends at any given time on two circumstances. First, on the technical relation of labour power employed to the mass of the means of production employed. Secondly, on the price of these means of production. This composition, as we have seen, must be examined on the basis of percentage ratios. We express the organic composition of a certain capital consisting 4/5 of constant and 1/5 of variable capital by the formula 80C plus 20V. It is furthermore assumed in this comparison that the rate of surplus value is unchangeable. Let it be any rate picked at random, say 100%. The capital of 80C plus 20V then produces a surplus value of 20S, and this yields a rate of profit of 20% on the total capital. The magnitude of the actual value of its product depends on the magnitude of the fixed part of the constant capital and on the portion which passes from it through wear and tear into the product. But since this circumstance has absolutely no bearing on the rate of profit, and hence, in the present analysis, we shall assume, for the sake of simplicity, that the constant capital is everywhere uniformly and entirely transferred to the annual product of the capitals. It is further assumed that the capitals in the different spheres of production annually realize the same quantities of surplus value proportionate to the magnitude of their variable parts. For the present, therefore, we disregard the difference which may be produced in this respect by variations in the duration of turnovers. This point will be discussed later. Let us take 5 different spheres of production, and let the capital in each have a different organic composition, as follows. Capital 1, 80C plus 20V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Therefore, surplus value equals 20, and value of product equals 120. Thus, rate of profit equals 20%. Capital 2. 70C plus 30V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Therefore, surplus value equals 30, and value of product equals 130. Thus, the rate of profit equals 30%. Capital 3. 60C plus 40V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Therefore, surplus value equals 40, and the value of product equals 140. Thus, the rate of profit equals 40%. Capital 4, 85C plus 15V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Therefore, the surplus value equals 15, and the value of the product equals 115. Thus, the rate of profit equals 15%. Capital 5, 95C plus 5V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Therefore, surplus value equals 5, and the value of the product equals 105. Thus, the rate of profit equals 5%. Here, in different spheres of production with the same degree of exploitation, we find considerably different rates of profit corresponding to the different organic composition of these capitals. The sum total of the capitals invested in these 5 spheres of production equals 500. The sum total of the surplus value produced by them equals 110. The aggregate value of the commodities produced by them equals 610. If we consider the 500 as a single capital, and capitals 1 to 5 merely as its component parts, as, say, different departments of a cotton mill, which has different ratios of constant to variable capital in its carding, preparatory spinning, spinning, and weaving shops, and in which the average ratio for the factory as a whole has still to be calculated, the mean composition of this capital of £500 would equal 390C plus 110V, or, in percent, equal 78C plus 22V. Should each of the capitals of 100 be regarded as one-fifth of the total capital, its composition would equal this average of 78C plus 22V. For every 100, there would be an average surplus value of 22. Thus, the average rate of profit would equal 22%. And, finally, the price of every fifth of the total product produced by the 500 would equal 122. The product of each fifth of the advanced total capital would then have to be sold at 122. But to avoid entirely erroneous conclusions, it must not be assumed that all cost prices equal 100. With 80C plus 20V and a rate of surplus value equal to 100%, the total value of commodities produced by Capital 1 equals 100 would be 80C plus 20V plus 20S equals 120, provided the entire constant capital went into the annual product. Now, this may, under certain circumstances, be the case in some spheres of production, but hardly in cases where the proportion of C to V equals 4:1. We must therefore remember, in comparing the values produced by each 100 of the different capitals, that they will differ in accordance with the different composition of C as to its fixed and circulating parts, and that in turn the fixed portions of each of the different capitals depreciate slowly or rapidly as the case may be, thus transferring unequal quantities of their value to the product in equal periods of time. But this is immaterial to the rate of profit. No matter whether the 80C give up a value of 80 or 50 or 5 to the annual product, and the annual product consequently equals 80C plus 20V plus 20S equals 120, or 50C plus 20V plus 20S equals 90, or 5V plus 20V plus 20S equals 45. In all these cases, the excess of the product's value over its cost price equals 20. And in calculating the rate of profit, these 20 are related to the capital of 100 in all of them. The rate of profit of Capital 1, therefore, is 20% in every case. To make this still plainer, we let different portions of constant capital go into the value of the product of the same five capitals as follows. Capital 1, 80C plus 20V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Surplus value, 20. Rate of profit, 20%. Used up constant capital, 50. Value of commodities, therefore, 50 plus 20 plus 20 equals 90. And the cost price equals 70. Capital 2. 70C plus 30V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Surplus value, 30. Rate of profit, 30%. Used up constant capital, 51. Value of commodities, therefore, 51 plus 30 plus 30 equals 111. And the cost price equals 81. Capital 3. 60C plus 40V. Rate of surplus value, 100%. Surplus value, 40. Rate of profit, 40%. Used up constant capital, 51. Value of commodities, therefore, 51 plus 40 plus 40 equals 131. And the cost price equals 91. Capital 4. 85C plus 15V. Rate of surplus value 100%. Surplus value 15. Rate of profit 15%. Used up constant capital 40. Value of commodities, therefore, 40 plus 15 plus 15 equals 70, and the cost price equals 55. Capital 5. 95C plus 5V. Rate of surplus value 100%. Surplus value 5. Rate of profit 5%. Used up constant capital 10. Value of commodities, therefore, 10 plus 5 plus 5 equals 20, and the cost price equals 15. Total capital 390C plus 110V. Surplus value 110, rate of profit 110%. Average capital 78C plus 22V. Surplus value 22, rate of profit 22%. If we now again consider capitals 1 to 5 as a single total capital, we shall see that, in this case as well, the composition of the sum of these five capitals, equals 500, equals 390C plus 110V, so that we get the same average composition, 78C plus 22V, and similarly, the average surplus value remains 22. If we divide this surplus value uniformly among capitals 1 to 5, we get the following commodity prices. Capital 1, 80C plus 20V. Surplus value 20, value of commodities 90, cost price of commodities 70, price of commodities equals 70 plus 22 equals 92. Rate of profit 22%. Deviation of price from value, plus 2. Capital 2, 70C plus 30V. Surplus value 30, value of commodities 111, cost price of commodities 81, price of commodities 81 plus 22 equals 103. Rate of profit, 22%. Deviation of price from value, minus 8. Capital 3, 60C plus 40V. Surplus value 40, value of commodities 131, cost price of commodities 91, price of commodities 91 plus 22 equals 113. Rate of profit 22%. Deviation of price from value minus 18. Capital 4, 85C plus 15V. Surplus value 15, value of commodities 70, cost price of commodities 55, price of commodities 55 plus 22 equals 77, rate of profit 22%, deviation of price from value plus 7. Capital 5, 95C plus 5V, surplus value 5, value of commodities 20, cost price of commodities 15, price of commodities 15 plus 22 equals 37, rate of profit 22%, deviation of price from value plus 17. Taken together, the commodities are sold at 2 plus 7 plus 17 equals 26 above, and 8 plus 18 equals 26 below their value, so that the deviations of price from value balance out one another through the uniform distribution of surplus value, or through addition of the average profit of 22 per 100 units of advanced capital to the respective cost prices of the commodities 1 to 5. One portion of the commodities is sold above its value in the same proportion in which the other is sold below it. And it is only the sale of the commodities at such prices that enables the rate of profit for capitals 1 to 5 to be uniformly 22%, regardless of their different organic composition. The prices which obtain as the average of the various rates of profit in the different spheres of production added to the cost prices of the different spheres of production, constitute the prices of production. They have as their prerequisite the existence of a general rate of profit, and this again presupposes that the rates of profit in every individual sphere of production, taken by itself, have previously been reduced to just as many average rates. These particular rates of profit equal surplus value over constant capital in every sphere of production, and must, as occurs in Part 1 of this book, be deduced out of the values of the commodities. Without such deduction, the general rate of profit, and consequently the price of production of commodities, remains a vague and senseless conception. Hence, the price of production of a commodity is equal to its cost price plus the profit allotted to it in percent in accordance with the general rate of profit, or in other words, to its cost price plus the average profit. Owing to the different organic compositions of capitals invested in different lines of production, and hence owing to the circumstance that, depending on the different percentage which the variable part makes up in the total capital of a given magnitude, capitals of equal magnitude put into motion very different quantities of labour. They also appropriate very different quantities of surplus labour, or produce very different quantities of surplus value. Accordingly, the rates of profit prevailing in the various branches of production are originally very different. These different rates of profit are equalized by competition to a single general rate of profit, which is the average of all these different rates of profit. The profit accruing in accordance with this general rate of profit to any capital of a given magnitude, whatever its organic composition, is called the average profit. The price of a commodity, which is equal to its cost price plus the share of the annual average profit on the total capital invested, not merely consumed in its production, that falls to it in accordance with the conditions of turnover, is called its price of production. Take, for example, a capital of 500, of which 100 is fixed capital, and let 10% of this wear out during one turnover of the circulating capital of 400. Let the average profit for the period of turnover be 10%. In that case, the cost price of the product created during this turnover will be 10C for wear plus 400C plus V circulating capital equals 410. And its price of production will be 410 cost price plus 10% profit on 500, 50, equals 460. Thus, although in selling their commodities the capitalists of the various spheres of production recover the value of the capital consumed in their production, they do not secure the surplus value, and consequently the profit created in their own sphere by the production of these commodities. What they secure is only as much surplus value, and hence profit, as falls, when uniformly distributed, to the share of every aliquot part of the total social capital from the total social surplus value or profit produced in a given time by the social capital in all spheres of production. Every 100 of an invested capital, whatever its composition, draws as much profit in a year or any other period of time as falls to the share of every 100, the nth part of the total capital, during the same period. So far as profits are concerned, the various capitalists are just so many stockholders in a stock company, in which the shares of profit are uniformly divided per 100, so that profits differ in the case of the individual capitalists only in accordance with the amount of capital invested by each in the aggregate enterprise. That is, according to his investment in social production as a whole, according to the number of his shares. Therefore, the portion of the price of commodities which replaces the elements of capital consumed in the production of these commodities, the portion, therefore, which will have to be used to buy back these consumed capital values, that is, their cost price, depends entirely on the outlay of capital within the respective spheres of production. But the other element of the price of commodities, the profit added to this cost price, does not depend on the amount of profit produced in a given sphere of production by a given capital in a given period of time. It depends on the mass of profit, which falls as an average for any given period to each individual capital as an aliquot part of the total social capital invested in social production. When a capitalist sells his commodities at their price of production, therefore, he recovers money in proportion to the value of the capital consumed in their production and secures profit in proportion to this advanced capital as the aliquot part in the total social capital. His cost prices are specific, but the profit added to them is independent of his particular sphere of production, being a simple average per 100 units of invested capital. Let us assume that the five different investments, 1 to 5, of the foregoing illustration belong to one man. The quantity of variable and constant capital consumed per 100 of the invested capital in each of the departments 1 to 5 in the production of commodities 1 to 5 would, needless to say, make up a part of their price, since at least this price is required to recover the advanced and consumed portions of the capital. These cost prices would therefore be different for each class of the commodities 1 to 5, and would, as such, be set differently by the owner. But as regards the different quantities of surplus value or profit produced by 1 to 5, they might easily be regarded by the capitalist as profit on his advanced aggregate capital, so that each 100 units would get their definite aliquot part. Hence, the cost prices of the commodities produced in the various departments 1 to 5 would be different, but that portion of their selling price derived from the profit added per 100 capital would be the same for all these commodities. The aggregate price of the commodities 1 to 5 would therefore equal their aggregate value, that is, the sum of the cost prices 1 to 5 plus the sum of the surplus values or profits produced in 1 to 5. It would hence actually be the money expression of the total quantity of past and newly applied labour incorporated in commodities 1 to 5. And in the same way, the sum of the prices of production of all commodities produced in society, the totality of all branches of production, is equal to the sum of their values. This statement seems to conflict with the fact that under capitalist production, the elements of productive capital are, as a rule, bought on the market, and that for this reason their prices include profit which has already been realized, hence include the price of production of the respective branch of industry, together with the profit contained in it, so that the profit of one branch of industry goes into the cost price of another. But if we place the sum of the cost prices of the commodities of an entire country on one side, and the sum of its surplus values or profits on the other, the calculation must evidently be right. For instance, take a certain commodity A. Its cost price may contain the profits of B, C, D, etc., just as the cost prices of B, C, D, etc. may contain the profits of A. Now, as we make our calculation, the profit of A will not be included in its cost price, nor will the profits of B, C, D, etc. be included in theirs. Nobody ever includes his own profit in his cost price. If there are, therefore, n spheres of production, and if each makes a profit amounting to P, and the symbol for the cost price of a single commodity is K, then their aggregate cost price equals K minus NP. Considering the calculation as a whole, we see that since the profits of one sphere of production pass into the cost price of another, they are therefore included in the calculation as constituents of the total price of the end product, and so cannot appear a second time on the profit side. If any do appear on this side, however, then it is only because the commodity in question is itself an ultimate product, whose price of production does not pass into the cost price of some other commodity. If the cost price of a commodity includes a sum equal to P, which stands for the profits of the producers of the means of production, and if a profit equals P1 is added to this cost price, the aggregate profit equals P plus P1. The aggregate cost price of the commodity, considered without the profit portions, is then its own cost price minus P plus P1. Let this cost price be K. Then, obviously, K plus the aggregate profit equals K plus P plus P1. In dealing with surplus values, we have seen in Volume 1 that the product of every capital may be so treated, as though a part of it replaces only capital, while the other part represents only surplus value. In applying this approach to the aggregate product of society, we must make some rectifications. Looking upon society as a whole, the profit contained in, say, the price of flax cannot appear twice, not both as a portion of the linen price and as the profit of the flax. There is no difference between surplus value and profit as long as, for example, A's surplus value passes into B's constant capital. It is, after all, quite immaterial to the value of the commodities whether the labour contained in them is paid or unpaid. This merely shows that B pays for A's surplus value. A's surplus value cannot be entered twice in the total calculation. But the difference is this. Aside from the fact that the price of a particular product, let us say that of capital B, differs from its value because the surplus value realized in B may be greater or smaller than the profit added to the price of the products of B, the same circumstance applies also to those commodities which form the constant part of capital B, and indirectly also its variable part, as the labourer's necessities of life. So far as the constant portion is concerned, it is itself equal to the cost price plus the surplus value, here therefore equal to cost price plus profit, and this profit may again be greater or smaller than the surplus value for which it stands. As for the variable capital, the average daily wage is indeed always equal to the value produced in the number of hours the labourer must work to produce the necessities of life. But this number of hours is in its turn obscured by the deviation of the prices of production of the necessities of life from their values. However, this always resolves itself to one commodity receiving too little of the surplus value, while another receives too much, so that the deviations from the value which are embodied in the prices of production compensate one another. Under capitalist production, the general law acts as the prevailing tendency only in a very complicated and approximate manner, as a never ascertainable average of ceaseless fluctuations. Since the general rate of profit is formed by taking the average of the various rates of profit for each 100 of capital invested in a definite period, for example a year, it follows that in it, the difference brought about by different periods of turnover of different capitals is also effaced. but these differences have a decisive bearing on the different rates of profit in the various spheres of production whose average forms the general rate of profit. In the preceding illustration concerning the formation of the average rate of profit, we assumed that each capital in each sphere of production is equal to 100, and we did so to show the difference in the rates of profit in percent, and thus also the difference in the values of commodities produced by equal amounts of capital. But it goes without saying that the actual amounts of surplus value produced in each sphere of production depend on the magnitude of the invested capitals, since the composition of capital is given in each sphere of production. Yet the actual rate of profit in any particular sphere of production is not affected by the fact that the capital invested is 100, or M times 100, or XM times 100. The rate of profit remains 10%, whether the total profit is 10 to 100, or 1,000 to 10,000. However, since the rates of profit differ in the various spheres of production, with very much different quantities of surplus value or profit being produced in them, depending on the proportion of the variable to the total capital, it is evident that the average profit per 100 of the social capital, and hence the average or general rate of profit, will differ considerably in accordance with the respective magnitudes of the capitals invested in the various spheres. Let us take four capitals, A, B, C, D. Let the rate of surplus value for all equal 100%. Let the variable capital for each 100 of the total be 25 in A, 40 in B, 15 in C, and 10 in D. Then each 100 of the total capital would yield a surplus value or profit of 25 in A, 40 in B, 15 in C, and 10 in D. This would total 90, and if these four capitals are of the same magnitude, the average rate of profit would then be 90 over 4, or 22.5%. Suppose, however, the total capitals are as follows. A equals 200, B equals 300, C equals 1,000, D equals 4,000. The profits produced would then respectively equal 50, 120, 150, and 400. This makes a profit of 720, and an average rate of profit of 13 1/11% for 5,500, the sum of the four capitals. The masses of the total value produced differ in accordance with the magnitudes of the total capitals invested in A, B, C, D, respectively. The formation of the average rate of profit is, therefore, not merely a matter of obtaining the simple average of the different rates of profit in the various spheres of production, but rather one of the relative weight which these different rates of profit have in forming this average. This, however, depends on the relative magnitude of the capital invested in each particular sphere, or on the aliquot part which the capital invested in each particular sphere forms in the aggregate social capital. There will naturally be a very great difference, depending on whether a greater or smaller part of the total capital produces a higher or lower rate of profit. And this, again, depends on how much capital is invested in spheres in which the variable capital is relatively small or large compared to the total capital. It is just like the average interest obtained by a usurer who lends various quantities of capital at different interest rates, for instance at 4, 5, 6, 7%, etc. The average rate will depend entirely on how much of his capital he has loaned out at each of the different rates of interest. The general rate of profit is therefore determined by two factors. One, the organic composition of the capitals in the different spheres of production, and thus the different rates of profit in the individual spheres, and two, the distribution of the total social capital in these different spheres, and thus the relative magnitude of the capital invested in each particular sphere at the specific rate of profit prevailing in it, that is, the relative share of the total social capital absorbed by each individual sphere of production. In Volumes 1 and 2, we dealt only with the value of commodities. On the one hand, the cost price has now been singled out as a part of this value, and on the other, the price of production of commodities has been developed as its converted form. Suppose the composition of the average social capital is 80C plus 20V, and the annual rate of surplus value, S prime, is 100%. In that case, the average annual profit for a capital of 100 equals 20, and the general annual rate of profit equals 20%. Whatever the cost price K of the commodities annually produced by a capital of 100, their price of production would then be K plus 20. In those spheres of production in which the composition of capital would equal 80 minus XC plus 20 plus XV, the actually produced surplus value, or the annual profit produced in that particular sphere, would be 20 plus X, that is, greater than 20. And the value of the produced commodities would equal K plus 20 plus X, that is, greater than K plus 20, or greater than their price of production. In those spheres in which the composition of the capital equals 80 plus XC plus 20 minus XV, the annually produced surplus value or profit would equal 20 minus X, or less than 20, and consequently the value of the commodities would equal K plus 20 minus X, less than the price of production, which equals K plus 20. Aside from possible differences in the periods of turnover, the price of production of the commodities would then equal their value only in spheres in which the composition would happen to be 80C plus 20V. The specific development of the social productivity of labour in each particular sphere of production varies in degree, higher or lower, depending on how large a quantity of means of production are set in motion by a definite quantity of labour. Hence, in a given working day, by a definite number of labourers, and consequently, on how small a quantity of labour is required for a given quantity of means of production. Such capitals as contain a larger percentage of constant and a smaller percentage of variable capital than the average social capital are, therefore, called capitals of higher composition. And conversely, those capitals in which the constant is relatively smaller and the variable relatively greater than in the average social capital, are called capitals of lower composition. Finally, we call those capitals whose composition coincides with the average, capitals of average composition. Should the average social capital be composed in percent of 80C plus 20V, then a capital of 90C plus 10V is higher, and a capital of 70C plus 30V lower than the social average. Generally speaking, if the composition of the average social capital equals MC plus NV, in which M and N are constant magnitudes and M plus N equals 100, the formula M plus XC plus N minus XV represents the higher composition, and M minus XC plus N plus XV, the lower composition of an individual capital or group of capitals. Here follows an illustration of the way in which these capitals perform their functions after establishment of an average rate of profit and assuming one turnover per year. Capital 1 represents the average composition with an average rate of profit of 20%. Capital 1. ATV plus 20V plus 20S. Rate of profit equals 20%. Price of product equals 120. Value equals 120. Capital 2. 90C plus 10V plus 10S. Rate of profit equals 20%. Price of product equals 120. Value equals 110. Capital 3. 70C plus 30V plus 30S. Rate of profit equals 20%. Price of product 120. Value equals 130. The value of the commodities produced by Capital 2 would, therefore, be smaller than their price of production. The price of production of the commodities of Capital 3, smaller than their value, and only in the case of Capital 1, in branches of production in which the composition happens to coincide with the social average, would value and price of production be equal. In applying these terms to any particular cases, note must, however, be taken whether a deviation of the ratio between C and V is simply due to a change in the value of the elements of constant capital, rather than to a difference in the technical composition. The foregoing statements have at any rate modified the original assumption concerning the determination of the cost price of commodities. We had originally assumed that the cost price of a commodity equaled the value of the commodities consumed in its production. But for the buyer, the price of production of a specific commodity is its cost price, and may thus pass as cost price into the prices of other commodities. Since the price of production may differ from the value of a commodity, it follows that the cost price of a commodity containing this price of production of another commodity may also stand above or below that portion of its total value derived from the value of the means of production consumed by it. It is necessary to remember this modified significance of the cost price, and to bear in mind that there is always the possibility of an error if the cost price of a commodity in any particular sphere is identified with the value of the means of production consumed by it. Our present analysis does not necessitate a closer examination of this point. It remains true, nevertheless, that the cost price of a commodity is always smaller than its value. Or no matter how much the cost price of a commodity may differ from the value of the means of production consumed by it, this past mistake is immaterial to the capitalist. The cost price of a particular commodity is a definite condition which is given and independent of the production of our capitalist, while the result of his production is a commodity containing surplus value, therefore an excess of value over and above its cost price. For all other purposes, the statement that the cost price is smaller than the value of a commodity has now changed practically into the statement that the cost price is smaller than the price of production. As concerns the total social capital, in which the price of production is equal to the value, this statement is identical with the former, namely that the cost price is smaller than the value. And while it is modified in the individual spheres of production, the fundamental fact always remains that in the case of the total social capital, the cost price of the commodities produced by it is smaller than their value. Or in the case of the total mass of social commodities, smaller than their price of production, which is identical with their value. The cost price of a commodity refers only to the quantity of paid labour contained in it, while its value refers to all the paid and unpaid labour contained in it. The price of production refers to the sum of the paid labour plus a certain quantity of unpaid labour, determined for any particular sphere of production by conditions over which it has no control. The formula that the price of production of a commodity equals K plus P, that is, equals its cost price plus profit, is now more precisely defined with P equal to KP prime, P prime being the general rate of profit. Hence, the price of production equals K plus KP prime. If K equals 300 and P prime equals 15%, then the price of production is K plus KP prime equals 300 plus 300 times 15 over 100, or 345. The price of production of the commodities in any particular sphere may change in magnitude thus. 1. If the general rate of profit changes independently of this particular sphere, while the value of the commodities remains the same, the same quantities of congealed and living labour being consumed in their production as before. 2. If there is a change of value, either in this particular sphere, in consequence of technical changes, or in consequence of a change in the value of those commodities which form the elements of its constant capital, while the general rate of profit remains unchanged. 3. Finally, if a combination of the two aforementioned circumstances takes place. In spite of the great changes occurring continually, as we shall see in the actual rates of profit within the individual spheres of production, any real change in the general rate of profit, unless brought about by way of an exception by extraordinary economic events, is the belated effect of a series of fluctuations extending over very long periods, fluctuations which require much time before consolidating and equalizing one another to bring about a change in the general rate of profit. In all shorter periods, quite aside from fluctuations of market prices, a change in the prices of production is, therefore, always traceable, prima facie, at first sight, to actual changes in the value of commodities, that is, to changes in the total amount of labour time required for their production. Mere changes in the money expression of the same values are naturally not at all considered here. On the other hand, it is evident that from the point of view of the total social capital, the value of the commodities produced by it, or expressed in money, their price, equals the value of constant capital plus the value of variable capital plus surplus value. Assuming the degree of labour exploitation to be constant, the rate of profit cannot change so long as the mass of surplus value remains the same, unless there is a change in either the value of the constant capital, the value of the variable capital, or the value of both, so that total capital changes and thereby surplus value over total capital, which represents the general rate of profit. In each case, therefore, a change in the general rate of profit implies a change in the value of commodities which form the elements of the constant or variable capital, or of both. Or the general rate of profit may change, while the value of commodities remains the same, when the degree of labour exploitation changes. Or, if the degree of labour exploitation remains the same, the general rate of profit may change through a change in the amount of labour employed relative to the constant capital as a result of technical changes in the labour process. But such technical changes must always show themselves in and be attended by a change in the value of the commodities, whose production would then require more or less labour than before. We saw in Part 1 that surplus value and profit are identical from the standpoint of their mass. But the rate of profit is from the very outset distinct from the rate of surplus value, which appears at first sight as merely a different form of calculating. But at the same time, this serves also from the outset to obscure and mystify the actual origin of surplus value, since the rate of profit can rise or fall, while the rate of surplus value remains the same, and vice versa. And since the capitalist is in practice solely interested in the rate of profit. Yet there was a difference of magnitude only between the rate of surplus value and the rate of profit, and not between the surplus value itself and profit. Since in the rate of profit the surplus value is calculated in relation to the total capital, and the latter is taken as its standard of measurement, the surplus value itself appears to originate from the total capital, uniformly derived from all its parts, so that the organic difference between constant and variable capital is obliterated in the conception of profit. Disguised as profit, surplus value actually denies its origin, loses its character, and becomes unrecognizable. However, hitherto, the distinction between profit and surplus value applied solely to a qualitative change, or change of form, while there was no real difference of magnitude in this first stage of the change between surplus value and profit, but only between the rate of profit and the rate of surplus value. But it is different as soon as a general rate of profit, and thereby an average profit corresponding to the magnitude of invested capital given in the various spheres of production, have been established. It is then only an accident if the surplus value, and thus the profit, actually produced in any particular sphere of production coincides with the profit contained in the selling price of a commodity. As a rule, surplus value and profit, and not their rates alone, are then different magnitudes. At a given degree of exploitation, the mass of surplus value produced in a particular sphere of production is then more important for the aggregate average profit of social capital, and thus for the capitalist class in general, than for the individual capitalist in any specific branch of production. It is of importance to the latter only in so far as the quantity of surplus value produced in his branch helps to regulate the average profit. But this is a process which occurs behind his back, one he does not see nor understand, and which, indeed, does not interest him. The actual difference of magnitude between profit and surplus value, not merely between the rate of profit and the rate of surplus value, in the various spheres of production now completely conceals the true nature and origin of profit, not only from the capitalist, who has a special interest in deceiving himself on this score, but also from the labourer. The transformation of values into prices of production serves to obscure the basis for determining value itself. Finally, since the mere transformation of surplus value into profit distinguishes the portion of the value of a commodity forming the profit from the portion forming its cost price, it is natural that the conception of value should elude the capitalist at this juncture, for he does not see the total labour put into the commodity, but only that portion of the total labour for which he has paid in the shape of means of production, be they living or not, so that his profit appears to him as something outside the inherent value of the commodity. Now, this idea is fully confirmed, fortified, and ossified in that, from the standpoint of his particular sphere of production, the profit added to the cost price is not actually determined by the limits of the formation of value within his own sphere, but through completely outside influences. The fact that this intrinsic connection is here revealed for the first time, that up to the present time, political economy as we shall see in the following and in Volume 4, either forcibly abstracted itself from the distinction between surplus value and profit and their rates, so it could retain value determination as a basis, or else abandoned this value determination, and with it all vestiges of a scientific approach, in order to cling to the differences that strike the eye in this phenomenon. This confusion of the theorists best illustrates the utter incapacity of the practical capitalist, blinded by competition as he is, and incapable of penetrating its phenomena, to recognize the inner essence and inner structure of this process behind its outer appearance. In fact, all the laws evolved in Part 1 concerning the rise and fall of the rate of profit have the following twofold meaning. 1. On the one hand, they are the laws of the general rate of profit. In view of the many different causes which make the rate of profit rise or fall, one would think, after everything that has been said and done, that the general rate of profit must change every day. But a trend in one sphere of production compensates for that in another. Their effects cross and paralyze one another. We shall later examine to which side these fluctuations ultimately gravitate. But they are slow. The suddenness, multiplicity, and different duration of the fluctuations in the individual spheres of production make them compensate for one another in the order of their succession in time, a fall in prices following a rise, and vice versa, so that they remain limited to local, that is, individual spheres. Finally, the various local fluctuations neutralize one another. Within each individual sphere of production, there take place changes, that is, deviations from the general rate of profit, which counterbalance one another in a definite time on the one hand, and thus have no influence upon the general rate of profit, and which, on the other, do not react upon it, because they are balanced by other simultaneous local fluctuations. Since the general rate of profit is not only determined by the average rate of profit in each sphere, but also by the distribution of the total social capital among the different individual spheres, and since this distribution is continually changing, it becomes another constant cause of change in the general rate of profit. But it is a cause of change which mostly paralyzes itself, owing to the uninterrupted and many-sided nature of this movement. 2. Within each sphere, there is some room for play for a longer or shorter space of time, in which the rate of profit of this sphere may fluctuate, before this fluctuation consolidates sufficiently after rising or falling to gain time for influencing the general rate of profit, and therefore assuming more than local importance. The laws of the rate of profit, as developed in Part 1 of this book, likewise remain applicable within these limits of space and time. The theoretical conception concerning the first transformation of surplus value into profit, that every part of a capital yields a uniform profit, expresses a practical fact. Whatever the composition of an industrial capital, whether it sets in motion one quarter of congealed labour and three quarters of living labour, or three quarters of congealed labour and one quarter of living labour, whether in one case it absorbs three times as much surplus labour, or produces three times as much surplus value than in another, in either case it yields the same profit, given the same degree of labour exploitation, and leaving aside individual differences, which, incidentally, disappear, because we are dealing in both cases with the average composition of the entire sphere of production. The individual capitalist, or all the capitalists in each individual sphere of production, whose outlook is limited, rightly believes that his profit is not derived solely from the labour employed by him, or in his line of production. This is quite true, as far as his average profit is concerned. To what extent this profit is due to the aggregate exploitation of labour on the part of the total social capital, that is, by all his capitalist colleagues, this interrelation is a complete mystery to the individual capitalist. All the more so, since no bourgeois theorists, the political economists, have so far revealed it. A saving of labour, not only labour necessary to produce a certain product, but also the number of employed labourers, and the employment of more congealed labour, constant capital, appear to be very sound operations from the economic standpoint, and do not seem to exert the least influence on the general rate of profit and the average profit. How could living labour be the sole source of profit, in view of the fact that a reduction in the quantity of labour required for production appears not to exert any influence on profit? Moreover, it even seems, in certain circumstances, to be the nearest source of an increase of profits, at least for the individual capitalist. If in any particular sphere of production there is a rise or fall of the portion of the cost price which represents the value of constant capital, this portion comes from the circulation, and, either enlarged or reduced, passes from the very outset into the process of production of the commodity. If, on the other hand, the same number of labourers produces more or less in the same time, so that the quantity of labour required for the production of a definite quantity of commodities varies while the number of labourers remains the same, that portion of the cost price which represents the value of the variable capital may remain the same, that is, contribute the same amount to the cost price of the total product. But every one of the individual commodities whose sum makes up the total product shares in more or less labour, paid and therefore also unpaid, and shares consequently in the greater or smaller outlay for this labour, that is, a larger or smaller portion of the wage. The total wages paid by the capitalist remain the same, but wages differ if calculated per piece of the commodity. Thus there is a change in this portion of the cost price of the commodity. But no matter whether the cost price of the individual commodity, or perhaps the cost price of the sum of commodities produced by a capital of a given magnitude, rises or falls, be it due to such changes in its own value or in that of its elements, the average profit of, for example, 10% remains 10%. Still, 10% of an individual commodity may represent very different amounts, depending on the change of magnitude caused in the cost price of the individual commodity by such changes of value as we have assumed. So far as the variable capital is concerned, and this is most important because it is the source of surplus value, and because anything which conceals its relation to the accumulation of wealth by the capitalist serves to mystify the entire system, matters get cruder or appear to the capitalist in the following light. A variable capital of £100 represents the weekly wage of, say, 100 labourers. If these 100 labourers weekly produce 200 pieces of a commodity, equals 200 total capital, in a given working time, then one total capital, abstracted from that portion of its cost price which is added by the constant capital, costs £100 over 200, equals 10 shillings, since £100 equals 200 total capital. Now suppose that a change occurs in the productiveness of labour. Suppose it doubles, so that the same number of labourers now produces twice 200 total capital in the time which it previously took to produce 200 total capital. In that case, considering only that part of the cost price which consists of wages, one total capital equals £100 over 400 equals 5 shillings, since now £100 equals 400 total capital. Should the productiveness decrease one half, the same labour would produce only 200 total capital over 2, and since £100 equals 200 total capital over 2, 1 total capital equals £200 over 2 equals £1. The changes in the labour time required for the production of the commodities, and hence the changes in their value, thus appear in regard to the cost price, and hence to the price of production, as a different distribution of the same wage for more or fewer commodities, depending on the greater or smaller quantity of commodities produced in the same working time for the same wage. What the capitalist, and consequently also the political economist, see is that the part of the paid labour per piece of commodity changes with the productivity of labour, and that the value of each piece also changes accordingly. What they do not see is that the same applies to unpaid labour contained in every piece of the commodity, and this is perceived so much less, since the average profit actually is only accidentally determined by the unpaid labour absorbed in the sphere of the individual capitalist. It is only in such crude and meaningless form that we can glimpse that the value of commodities is determined by the labour contained in them.